As instructed by my vice chair. This is, first up is, this is under Zoom, so I have to do the, this is not under Zoom, right? Okay. All right, so I don't have to do roll call. First up is new business, 2A, which is land use building and urban renewal bill summary from the 2021 legislative session.
Thank you, Derek Tokos, Community Development. What I thought I'd do is kind of just kind of go through them one at a time, just talk briefly about them. And if you have questions or issues on any of the particular bills, feel free to stop me as I go along. Then the plan was to go into the, for the solutions memo, the TSP piece, I was just going to, I have the maps queued up for the project, various projects in the project list, thought we'd go through that as well, and not try to go into anything else above and beyond that because it's just too much to tackle. But if you have specific issues on something on a particular page or in the document or an issue, let me know. I'd like to flag them. And then, as you all know, we have one hearing, but it's a continuance. Jim and I talked in advance that, you know, if it's all right with everybody else and we need another 10, 15 minutes to wrap up, we'll just break at 7 o'clock, take care of the continuance and pop back in the work session and wrap things up. So I'll start with the bill summary. So what I sent you was actually in a PDF form where you could actually click on the bill number if you wanted to look at the full bill and take a look at it. This legislative session was a lot about housing again, and wildfire responses were two of the big issues that we'll be talking about as we go through there. There are also some changes in building codes that are worth talking about, too. So the first one, House Bill 2006, which I have up there. This is an emergency shelter supersiding bill akin to what they did during the short session. It's got a limited window, but basically it's if you want to locate a shelter, you can do that between now and July 1st of 2022, and you're not subject to any land use regulations above and beyond, say, your hazard stuff, which I listed here. So floodplain stuff would apply. Geologic hazards would apply. But none of your basic zoning would apply. There would be no public process. That's intentional. The legislature, for trying to get these shelters through, they do this legislation because shelters are so hard to approve in a jurisdiction, because wherever they land, there's a constituency there that doesn't want them. And so that's why they put a bill of this nature together. I think the big catch here is if a shelter is to be located, you have to have a housing authority or a nonprofit with experience in operating them, operate it. We don't have that.
Excuse me, you're talking about permanent shelters.
Emergency shelters.
Temporary emergency shelters. Like for the wildfire or anything. That's something different.
Well, I think like your winter shelter could fall under this. Just, you know, warming shelter type stuff.
This is not permanent.
This is not permanent housing. Okay. This is an emergency shelter. Now, this could be year-round shelter services or seasonal. I think both would fit within this category.
Okay. All right.
This is that one that went around and around in Lincoln City, I believe it was. Or Lincoln City or Depot Bay, one of the two that had a place that they were renting from.
Oh, yeah. It was across the parking lot.
Lincoln City. I believe Lincoln City does have a shelter. Northwest Coastal Housing, I believe, is operating a shelter up there at this point in time. You know, this, I suspect, will be a discussion with the city council when they start to come to terms with how they want to approach some of the ARPA money that we'll be receiving, you know. And so we'll see how that goes. This might be an opportunity to get a shelter in place. We have the fairgrounds that's not going to be available, within the next year or two. They're going to start, you know, moving forward with the Commons project. That's the only winter warming shelter that we've had. So I suspect that's going to be a topic of some discussion with the council. let me see. Oh, another provision in there. The bill eliminated that three vehicle limit for car camping. Mm-hmm. That was in statute that went away. So if
now can I whine about the car camping things?
I'm sorry.
Can I whine about the car camping stuff now?
Sure, go for it.
Hey, I'm a little annoyed because the city put it in the parking lot, kitty corner from my house. Mm-hmm. So I have a really good view of what's going on over there. Most of the time, it don't bother me, actually, but it does bother my tenants a lot because they're having fights and stuff. They're piling stuff outside the cars, and occasionally they come by and make them clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
Comes and goes. But they don't have 24-hour access to a bathroom. They put a porta potty out there, but unfortunately, the porta potty has a homeless person sleeping in it every night.
Yeah.
So that's my take on the
management issues.
Car camping. Yeah.
Well, that's the challenge, and we talked about that. Whatever the city's doing is not actively managed. I mean, there's nobody providing. Oversight.
Yeah, and that's what we outside were trying the, to do. I mean, with to
the, if a church wants to do it, you've got to have, it's right. Got to be staffed 24/7.
Right.
But if the city wants to do it, they just say, yeah, go ahead, and that's it.
Yeah, there's nobody to provide that oversight.
Well, you know, nobody's outside objecting of the, to what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
It's undoubtedly something you guys are going to want to, and the council will probably want to revisit at some point. How's it working? Should we continue to operate at this location? I don't know that we're there yet. But I do know the council's asked on a couple occasions of our police department, is that a valuable resource, you know, where you can direct folks? And he said, yes, you know, it's not been frequent, but we do send folks there.
Are you going to put your couplet, Highway 20 couplet, through there?
Couplet option puts traffic on 9th.
Yeah.
So that's that bill.
How many people are standing?
There's one semi-permanent person, and then they do have people that cycle through.
Right.
They're only there for a few days and mm-hmm. then they're gone.
They go.
Yeah. And those ones usually aren't the problem. The gal that lives there is having a fight with her boyfriend at 2 a.m. in the morning. So, oh. You know, don't you touch me and I'm calling the cops and at the top of her lungs. So, hey.
Why don't you go out and give her some Ripple or Boone's Farm?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm gonna cruise right along or we'll be here till 9 p.m. if it needs a lot of bills. So. House Bill 2008, it's some legislation that requires us to allow affordable housing projects that are on property that are where you have a religious use, even if that property is not zoned for residential purposes, so it's industrial or commercial. I think the kicker in here is, though, that it has to be adjacent to residential property. This might be something we want to work into the land use code as part of a, you know, pick up odds and ends through the legislation, but I don't know that it's particularly operable. I don't see it having a whole lot of impact.
Okay, so as long as we're interrupting and going off topic, what's going on over there on 12th behind the church?
I think they're still looking for grant money to even move the project forward. You're talking about the Presbyterian Church?
Yeah, I saw a big sign about a public meeting.
Right, well, I think the plan was to build 5 small mini homes for single parents who have children so they'd have easy access to the Sam Case School. But they don't have the money. They're partnering with Habitat for Humanity. And so at this point, they're in the phase where they're seeking folks to help them write grants. I don't believe there's been outreach to the folks back there on Chambers Court or the surrounding neighbors.
So there was a sign right there at
the corner. But it's still in a very preliminary stage.
Okay. Yeah, they've talked to us a couple different times and the concept's adjusted a little bit here and there. But I do want to point out that's actually residentially zoned where the housing's already permissible. This bill extends it to commercial and industrial. So it's a little bit different in that regard. But House Bill 2312, kind of a quirky little bill that just clarified that the judgment's coming out of circuit court. As long as they're not creating additional units of land, basically it's a boundary dispute issue that ends up in circuit court, and the judge says this is where your common property line is, we have to recognize that basically as a property line adjustment. Okay. not the worst thing in the world. You've seen some of those things resolved, especially sometimes where it's what's a line that impacts 3, 4, 5, 6 different properties because it's, you know, it ends up in court. It's one way to address it. House Bill 2180, this one's a little bit more meaningful, and there's going to be the State Building Codes Division has to kick out some rulemaking on this one. We will now be requiring for commercial projects, mixed-use projects, and multifamily projects, the mixed-use and multifamily being those with 5 units or more, they have to design for EV charging. They don't have to install the stations, but they got to size the service. They got to run the conduit. They have to identify a location for the charging stations, and they have to design it with an eye towards serving at least 20% of their required parking spaces. So Building Codes Division is going to kick that out here soon. This nullifies that opt-in Oregon administrative rule that our city council wanted to go in. So we'll just wait for the new rulemaking and fall under that. It's the new rule is actually stricter than the current opt-in administrative rule.
You don't have to upsize the service, right, until you actually implement the system, right? So you're EV ready, so you have the conduit, but you don't actually have to pay for the additional meter service until you install.
Right, but you gotta size the service.
Make sure that PUD is comfortable upgrading it. Eventually.
Exactly. I think that's where that's landing, Dustin, on that one.
And that's probably gonna upsize the transformers on the pole. I mean, that's a lot of power.
You know,
that's going to be
a project by project kind of deal where you sort it out. What's PUD's capabilities in a particular location? How big is the project? How many parking spaces do they need to provide service for? This is level 2 chargers, so the demand's not quite as heavy as that big beast of a setup we have up at Walmart, which is that high speed charging, which has a quite a bit more demand than the level 2s have. But
this wouldn't affect the new hotel, would it?
The Nye Beach Hotel that we talked about.
They're gonna need to address this when they actually get to a point where they're constructing. That's my suspicion.
Oh. Yeah, they won't have a building permit. This stuff will go be in the.
They're not in a position. I just talked to them today. They're still. The whole Delta variant thing is throwing a monkey wrench into financing. Is so skittish right now that they're still waiting for some of the dust to settle on that so that they can proceed with their project. They'd like to, but it's just challenging times. And they have a little bit of time with what was negotiated with the city. Remember, that particular property has a buyback provision in it because it was an urban renewal property that was made available, and that hook is still there. So, but they have some time.
The state's required this on state-funded projects for a while. So, like affordable housing projects that have state money, or that we've worked on, and a Department of Forestry project that we've worked on. And honestly, I don't think the cost implications are as big as people like to like throw up their hand and make this sound like a huge problem. But
I can't hear you very well, probably because of the mask. Sorry. Can you talk into the microphone?
I was just going to say, I don't think like this, the cost implications of it aren't that intense. You know, we've dealt with it on a Department of Forestry project and a affordable housing project that's has state funds, and it's not that expensive, right? You're just putting in conduit and identifying a place to put in chargers in the future. So I think this is one that where a lot of people like throw up their hands and are upset about, but it makes sense. You know, it's just like flexible conduit for the future for when people end up driving electronic or electric vehicles.
Right. Because it's going to cost a whole lot more to retrofit those buildings and parking lots later than it is to get. Yeah. Later.
Yeah.
So.
And does PUD do they charge you to make a bigger transformer?
They charge you for everything.
Yeah, most definitely. And you have no.
So once you put it in, you're going to be paying through the nose for the transformer upgrade. Okay.
Like trying to argue with your water bill.
HB 2364, Harbor Village RV Park went through this process recently. The legislature basically, this bill gives, provides a little bit more time in the process for those that live in a RV park that's, you know, put up for sale to get organized so they could potentially purchase it. That's what that's about. That's not something we are directly involved in, although we're consulted along the way in that process. In part because oftentimes, like, and Harbor Village is going to be going through this, one of the catches on that is they're going to have to upgrade a lot of their internal infrastructure as part of the purchase. And so there's discussions ongoing about that kind of stuff. HB 2415, everybody gets to do e-permitting. So that hasn't been, I mean, there are still a number of jurisdictions out there, believe it or not, that do not offer electronic permitting. But now that's mandated. And so that's, everybody's got to transition to either the state's e-permitting system, or if they do their own system, like some of the larger jurisdictions do, they have to have the same functionality. So that's how it works.
I have a question on that. Do you have to? Like, is the city of Newport going to only do e-permitting?
No, no, no. It's not. You'll, we have to offer it. Yeah. That's all we have to do. We don't. No, it's not exclusively e-permitting. We just have to offer it.
I think eventually it's going to go probably exclusively e-permitting, right? Someday. So.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Yeah. You know, I mean.
Especially for Newport and smaller jurisdictions. Yeah, that well, people even, are used to just dropping off plans and going in and talking through it.
Well, you deal with all types. You know, and there's still a lot of folks that aren't comfortable working through an electronic permitting system. They'd rather come in and bring in whatever they, you know, drafted up at their kitchen table.
Yeah.
2560, we have to, you know, this basically says we have to afford folks an op, you know, if we allow in-person testimony, we have to provide at least a telephone as a way for somebody to participate. It's either video conference or a phone line. We have to do something. So we have to make that option. Now, here's the interesting twist that Bill has is it says that if you allow somebody to provide written testimony in person, we have to allow whoever's online to provide testimony live too, which would be via email. So we're gonna have to provide an email address in our notices as if they wanna provide testimony during the course of a meeting, they can do it that way. Like, you guys will ever read it, but you guys can't even read the stuff that's submitted written
at a meeting,
the fly at a meeting. But that's it's trying to get at equal access electronically versus in person. Oh, House Bill 2583. We caught this one going through in the session and fortunately got it tweaked. Otherwise, it would have caused big time problems with short term rental regulations. But at the end of the day, basically, it's saying we cannot impose occupancy limits based on familiar or non familial relationships. We will need to amend our code to comply with this. Like most jurisdictions, Newport has for decades a provision that kind of defined a family as, you know, up to five unrelated individuals, you know, no can do. We're just going to get rid of that family definition. It's going to cause us problems under this particular bill. So,
as the
but you can still put occupancy limits on vacation rentals, right?
Yes. Because that occupancy limit is not based on the familial or non-familial relationship of the people there.
Okay.
We base it off of parking.
Yeah, but say I show up with me and my 13 brothers and all their family at a vacation rental.
We base it off of parking. We're okay. We'll be fine.
Max is 12. Maximum occupancy.
I know,
for a vacation rental is 12.
But right. This says
flat out 12.
Okay.
Count heads.
Yeah. All right.
We're not basing it. We'll be okay. We're not. We don't. We didn't base the occupancy limits for short-term rentals based on somebody's familial or non-familial relationship.
It's just strictly a body count.
It's strictly a body count that relates to availability of parking in large degree. That's what keys in, you know.
And bedrooms.
And bedrooms. So, same goes with, you know, fire life safety codes. Those are okay too. As this was originally drafted, this would have been very problematic. Because it was like, you can't have occupancy limits at all.
Oh, that would have worked good.
Hey, wait a minute.
That'd be okay. Like right next to your house.
What it's getting at, you know, is those definitions, you know, you have a lot of situations now where you have, you know, extended family groups living in the same home. It's getting at archaic standards that really don't have a place in codes. There's really no reason why, you know, we would be regulating based on a familial relationship.
What they call intergenerational.
Intergenerational, you know, housing, that kind of deal. House Bill 2605, basically it says risk category 3 and 4, this is a building code one, risk category 3 and 4 buildings located within a tsunami inundation zone have to be designed to the what ASCE 7 standards for tsunami load. So that's the most current engineering standard for dealing with the anticipated impact of a tsunami wave as it slams into your building. Most of the uses that are listed here, we don't allow with the tsunami hazards overlay. We prohibited them within the inundation area, but there are a few category 3 and 4 uses that are allowed where we could have need to apply these standards.
That means any new motels that go on South Beach? Down on the...
If it has an occupancy load greater than 300.
But what is...
So if it had large meeting space on a main level, for example, assembly area, that's where they're probably going to get into it.
Okay.
A small boutique, you know, hotel, motel, probably won't trigger it. Okay. So it's going to be kind of a case by case to see what's the occupancy load for that particular facility.
What about temporary structures like seafood and wine? Not covered?
I don't think so. No. Okay. This is a building code issue. The temporary structures aren't going to come under building code because they're not up long enough. Two 607 provides that residential housing. This is one of those that we're going to need to address in our code. Basically, it exempts replacement homes that are destroyed by fire or other disaster from having to pay excise taxes. So the one we collect for the school district, this was a big deal for the fire up by Lincoln City, and, you know, where the school district said, hey, we don't want to have to charge these excise taxes, but we have no way to waive them. That's what that was part of that piece. But it applies to all excise taxes, so our affordable housing one's hooked on this as well. So that's just how it'll work. We'll just need to acknowledge that they're not payable if it's a replacement dwelling that was lost by...
Yeah, but it also says it's you got to have a state of emergency declaration, though, right?
Correct, and we'll put that in there. We'll put all that whole verbiage in there. It's got to be a... correct.
Okay.
A reasonably, not an isolated one, but one that affects enough people that...
Because otherwise somebody would come, I don't have to pay that.
Right. HB 2809, again, wildfire related. This has to do with the sighting of recreational vehicles on properties as they're rehabbing. So that's one we'll probably need to work into our code. We do have an allowance for that under our temporary use provisions, but I'll need to take a look and see. We may need to tweak that a little bit to comply with the terms of this. It's got some interesting language in there about, or such other date that the local government establishes because it's determined the owner's unreasonably delaying repairs, which I could see happening in some of these cases. Not, I mean, just because they don't have the wherewithal to do it. You know, where the damage is so extensive and their financial resources are limited enough, maybe they didn't have insurance at all to cover it. No.
Is natural disasters a defined term?
I'll have to look. I would expect it is, or at least one that we could, you know, when we do some code changes, can put some sidebars on.
I mean, I'm thinking of 70 whatever street fell into Schooner Creek.
Right.
So the guy that decided to stay and beef up his house, this would allow him to put an RV on either that lot or.
While he's working on it.
While he's working on it.
Yep.
FEMA has one.
Yep, and we have something. It's just I'm not sure we our deadlines match up with what's in this bill. I just need to take a look at it. We may need to tweak our code a little bit.
Bob, FEMA has a definition.
Yeah.
It's really clear, and it takes into account human caused issues too.
Yeah. House Bill 2884. It's a situation where, and these come up very rarely, where somebody's validating a unit of land that wasn't lawfully created in the first place, was not lawfully divided. This is done by partition plat. It's more common in the unincorporated than in incorporated areas. And what this basically says is they have more time to get the plat filed.
Okay, this is the rare case stuff. I was going, man, why are they changing that?
This is rare. No, this is rare. So this is a case where somebody... You don't see it too often. It's not something we have to deal with very often, but in the rural areas, you deal with it more frequently where somebody divided their property by deed. You can't do that anymore. You used to be able to do that, but you can't just walk in and say you had 40 acres and write a new meets and bounds description, carving off 20 and selling it to somebody. That's not lawful. Hasn't been for decades. Can't do it that way.
But you could do minor land partition, but not... creating multiple lots, you know.
Well, there's processes for dividing property, and they have to comply with zoning requirements. And so, yeah, there's a partition process and then subdivision. Partitions being easier than subdivisions more complex.
What would be the rationale for extending the window to record the plat?
One of the big reasons is it takes a while sometimes to get the final partition plats through county surveyors' offices. They get backlogged. Then there's corrections that need to be made, and the surveying community is pretty time-limited right now. Just getting a surveyor to pick it back up again to make the corrections can take quite a while because they're busy out doing other jobs. I think the flip side of that's what's the harm? You know, if it's gone through the process and been recognized as lawful and they're going through the exercise at this point of getting the final technical details sorted out on the partition plat, what's the harm giving them some more time to do it? Otherwise, I got to go back through the process and you're kind of wasting people's time at that point. House Bill 2918, we have a new reporting requirement. We have to inventory any surplus real property we have and report it to the Department of Land Conservation and Development, who will now maintain an online database of surplus government property that might be available for housing purposes. So we'll see how that goes.
Just for housing?
That's what it's targeted to, for the purpose of developing affordable housing.
And how much does City of Newport have of that?
We have nothing that's been designated as surplus that would be suitable for that purpose. But I have to report that, so.
Have we ever designated any real property as surplus?
That has to be formally done by the city council. It's done on a case-by-case basis.
So how do the habitat stuff, how do we do that?
They made that determination that it was surplus, but it's a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
They haven't gone through and said, out of all of these properties, and the council has looked at all of the city's properties before. They haven't gone through all that and said, we think A, B, C, D, and E are surplus and done that in one fell swoop. What they'll do is as an issue comes up, they've taken that action where they felt it was appropriate.
So this will be an ongoing inventory
every two years.
Okay.
So we'll just be reporting.
Yeah.
And we'll just add it to, we report to them on a number of other things already. So we'll just add that to the mix. House Bill 3040. It's kind of setting the stage for some legislation on SDCs, probably the next full session. They want to report on it, a fairly detailed report out of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to see where basically system development charge costs fall in the overall cost of housing. And so that's what this analysis is going to be. They put it on a pretty short timeline, And I mean, they have to have a preliminary report to back to the legislature at the end of this year. They're in the process of trying to get somebody lined up to do the work. A final report by June 1st of 2022. So we'll see.
How hard is it going to be? They want you to post the.
I have all that. We already have all that up on our website. I'll double check just to make sure we're not missing anything. But most of that stuff's already up there. We have the full methodology up there. We have the worksheets. All of that's up there.
Okay.
Covered the preliminary.
I'm sorry?
Preliminary report.
The preliminary report, that they have to do a preliminary and a final. Their preliminary in December 31st, 2021. My guess is probably an outline of what they're going to try to accomplish in their report. That's probably the best they'll be able to do by then. That's a guess, though. League of Oregon Cities is watching this one carefully. We'll want to watch this one carefully. See where it goes. I think one of the challenges in the reason on the online stuff is there are a lot of areas where you just have special districts that have SDCs, and in some cases those special districts aren't particularly web savvy, so they don't have any of that stuff up. So maybe it's a water district in a particular community or a sewer district in a particular community, and that's, you know, and that community only has a water or a wastewater SDC, and they don't have, because not all communities have SDCs for all of the different types of utilities. So I think that's where they were driving at. House Bill 3109 establishes child care facilities as permitted uses in all commercial and industrial zoned areas. We're going to have to adjust our code a little bit. We don't allow them outright in tourist commercial zones, for example, so we're going to have to go and amend our code a little bit.
Do we allow them in water dependent?
You know, I'm going to need to get an interpretation as to whether or not this applies to water dependent. Commercial or industrial is often not construed to include shoreline.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering because it's like
right.
That's the other one.
Yeah, that's one that I was thinking I'm going to need to get a read on that one. House Bill 3115 deals codifies the Martin v. City of Boise court decision that, you know, basically says, you know, we need to be careful in terms of how we handle and work with people who are experiencing homelessness. We can't just, you know, run them off of any location in the city. We have to, you know, it has to be reasonable, objectively reasonable in terms of our actions. So, you know, for example, if somebody's sleeping in an area of lawn that's not used for any other purpose, we really would have to have some pretty significant cause to roust them out and move them.
About whereas the stairwells of the seniors.
Well, I was going to say, whereas if they're sleeping in, say, a bus stop, a bus shelter, when bus service is operational, we would have good cause to be able to say, hey, look, not here, because other people need to use this. Same with obstructing a sidewalk or an access to a building like a stairwell that you're talking about. I thought that might be where you're going with it.
Well, right across the entrance to the rec center,
right.
There's the downstairs entrance to the senior center. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of folks living down there now.
Mm-hmm.
That's an emergency access. You can run them out of there. That's an emergency access.
Right.
So that they can't be there.
So our police department's working through this, you know, where they can and, you know, where they have better cause to say, hey, you gotta get out of here, or they need to just let them be and let them rest.
Can you
we have some time to implement this. This is something the city council is going to be talking about. Part of this too is should the city be designating a formal place where they can go and sleep, and which then gives the city a little bit more leeway in terms of asking people to move, because there's a place you can direct them to.
Such a conflict.
I'm sorry. It is such
a conflict. I'm sorry, Greg. Newport? Zero. That's the problem. We don't have an overnight shelter. That would help immensely. A police department would love that, to be able to say, hey, you can go to the shelter.
Right.
You know, but we don't have that.
From what I read, there's some percentage of the unhoused population who, even if shelters are available, elect not to go because of either there's a rule, whether it's an animal or a relationship with another person, or
absolutely, absolutely,
or being impaired. So there's some folks who just will reject the concept of a shelter.
Yeah, no, absolutely, that's true. You know, I was coming at it from the at least, you know, the police would then have a place they could send people to.
Mm-hmm.
House Bill 3124 requires extended notice, basically, for cleaning out unlawful campsites. So from 24 hours to 72, and I believe the bill says you have to make sure that any stuff they seize in the course of cleaning out those camps has to be available locally.
Now, does this apply? Is this applying to public grounds or is this applying to private grounds?
I didn't see a distinction in there. I mean, I'd have to go back and look at the bill, Jim. We don't get involved on private. Typically, we would only be involved in public.
Okay.
For law enforcement.
For law enforcement. Okay, so we
don't clean out. I mean, we trespass people off private property, so I guess you could say that. But we wouldn't be in the camp cleaning mode on private property. We deal with that on public property.
Okay. Do you know, is there some cleanup or enforcement action over there on the east side of the highway, north of, basically where that memorial for that kid that was killed.
They were doing something there the other day.
There's a bunch of bags of, you know, personal kind of items up on the
shoulder. Yeah, I saw a couple guys cleaning it up, packing it in bags.
But that wasn't any kind of enforcement action. That was just a...
I don't know. What I do know is we do dedicate quite a bit of time to camp cleanups. Jovita spends a Ballantyne, one of our CSOs, spends a fair amount of her time working on those types of issues.
Is there a time limit on those memorials that people have for
somebody cut that one down, cut up all the
Is there a time limit?
Well, the technical I thought at one time
there was 2 years that you could do that.
I don't think,
I don't know.
For ODOT, there's no time limit.
No time limit?
They will come by and take them down. Yeah, if it's on ODOT's property,
they'll take them down.
They'll take them down. I so I don't know if there's a rule for county or something else.
Yeah.
House Bill 3219 deals with, this is another wildfire related one, which is if your manufactured dwelling park's destroyed, you can replace it and you don't have to prove that the units there were, you know, lawful. So if you had put in two or three or four units without proper permits, whole thing burns down, you can still put them back. That's what it's driving at.
You don't have to bring it up to code.
You don't have to show that the total number of units that you want to replace were lawful in the first place. That's what it's talking about.
Wow. But the new ones have to be lawful.
Well, you have to comply with the park codes for constructing a new manufactured park. This was getting at how many lawful units you were permitted to have, you know, so. House Bill 3261, this gets at conversion of hotels and motels into emergency shelters. This is one we'll want to probably put some code together. So basically it says you have to allow hotel motel conversions to emergency shelters or affordable housing.
Isn't that already happening?
To a point, if you certainly have the program where hotel and motel rooms are being reserved and paid for housing folks. I think this goes a little bit further. If it's turning it into affordable housing, that then, you know, what's it going to take to do that?
Okay,
most hotels, motels are not constructed such that a room can be is you know, suitable for long-term housing.
Okay, so this is a conversion from a typical hotel motel.
Correct.
To a shelter rather than a, like what happened here in our community, a winter type opportunity.
Correct.
For some people to get out of the weather for 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, different concept. SB 8, this is one we'll want to take a hard look at. This requires local governments to approve the development of certain affordable housing. Can't do a conditional use permit, zone change. On land, zone to allow commercial uses. The one piece on this that I will need an interpretation on is, does this mean that you have to allow affordable housing in the tourist commercial zones or in the water-related zones, like down on the bayfront? Right now, we do allow, but it can't be on the main floor. Will that type of provision still be permissible? I don't know. That's some stuff that needs to get sorted out.
I don't see it. I don't understand how somebody would buy a commercial property and turn it into affordable housing. I mean, I don't understand the economics of it. So,
you know, well, if you're paying fair market value, that makes sense. But what if you had a benefactor who was going to donate the property?
Okay.
You know, if that stuff does happen, you know, it does come up from time to time, or provide it to you at a discount because they want to see that type of project happen.
Oh, okay.
SB 405, this is another wildfire-related one, preempts a non-conforming use from being considered interrupted or abandoned during the course of local emergency order. So probably need to tweak our non-conforming use. We have some provisions already in place for non-conforming where you're replacing because you lost your home from a fire or something equivalent. The timing piece of this, we may need to work into that code a little bit.
They're taking out to 2025 then for wildfires, which is actually probably pretty close to when some of these places may not even start until then. I mean, given the
right, there's the one that's specific to there's the ongoing piece that goes with SB 405, and then there's the little carve out they're dealing with just the September 2020 wildfires. The ongoing piece is the one we're going to want to deal with in our code. SB 458. This is another one we're going to need to probably take a look at with some guidance already from DLCD on this. This is, you know, we have to offer, there's already an expedited land division process in statute, and it's been incorporated somewhat in our subdivision code. We have to offer it with some additional caveats for anything that's built under the HB 2001, so the duplexes for us, you know, all the stuff you guys went through on the House Bill 2001, the cottage clusters. They could build that, and then they can turn around and divide it, and we have to authorize that through an expedited process. And so those land divisions won't go to you. We have to handle them at an administrative level. That's just a function of the law and how fast it has to happen. So that's what that's about.
This doesn't allow them to do anything that you don't normally do, right? I mean.
Well, we still have the abilities to put in place certain standards, like they have to have street frontage. They can't just go create, like a cottage cluster, which has a common area. You can't go just carve off lots without street frontage. We have the ability to influence that. It's in the bill, and I'll bring it forward at a future work session for us to kind of begin to. We'll have some time to get that straight. SB 762 was the omnibus wildfire related bill. Near term, it gets at the wildland urban interface, basically those rural areas that kind of ring urban areas. And Oregon Department of Forestry and OSU are tasked with doing some mapping on that, which they have to get done. Eventually, this is probably going to lead to some defensible space and building code changes. So stricter building codes, you know, more fire-resistant materials, construction materials. Defensible space could be tricky. That could be a tough one on local governments because not only are you, you know, having to go in and make sure that the vegetation is cleared away from the home, day one when it's built, but then you have to go in periodically and check it, and that's labor intensive. So we want to proceed cautiously on that one. I don't know. Rob and I have been talking. My suspicion is that given where we're located on the coast, we aren't going to be a top priority for some of this stuff. They're going to be looking at some of the areas that are more fire prone. But this will eventually make its way our way. SB 866 was a legislative fix to a Department of Justice opinion that said we couldn't use contract inspectors. They all had to be public employees, which is a problem for not only smaller jurisdictions like Newport, where, you know, we have a number of types of specialty inspections where we don't have enough traffic to justify having a full-time employee to handle those. But even larger jurisdictions, because building is one of those things where it ebbs and flows, and we still have an obligation to provide those inspections and those plan reviews in a timely manner. And so you supplement that with contract services. So this fixes that. We can do that. We can use contract services. There are some new auditing provisions in the bill. They are to be treated as public employees when they're acting as a city or county inspector. I mean, so there's some stuff in there that addresses this, but for purposes of government ethics, they're public officials. So I noted some of the key pieces, but it's a good thing.
So they get to get sit through the ethics training too then.
Yeah.
And who's responsible for oversight of these public officials?
The local jurisdiction. So it'd be myself and at times Joseph for Newport. We're the ones responsible for those inspectors when they're acting as City of Newport contract inspectors.
What is the cost of making the inspector a public employee versus a contract employee? Or an independent contractor, I guess, is what they'd be.
Well, there's certainly a cost issue. I think the issue for us is we can't. The what you run into is your building officials, and I worked pretty hard when we recruited to pull somebody with Joseph's qualifications in, where he has a whole range of different certifications. There's a whole battery of certifications that you have to do inspections on the plumbing, mechanical, electrical, structural, residential, structural, commercial. And it's very strict, and it's tough to get some of those certifications, particularly the trade ones like an A-level electrical, because they don't want people inspecting unless they've been electricians for 20 years. I mean, it gets that way. I mean, it's tough to get all those certifications. And however, we have to provide that service. So we couldn't hire enough and have a cost-effective program, which we have to have. You know, this is supposed to be a it pays for itself program. If we had all of those as public employees, now we try to get creative, you know, cost share. You know, we've done that with the county, you know, where we're cost sharing with an A-level electrician, where that individual is a county employee, but they basically work on contract, you know, for us for 2 or 3 days a week. But we can't escape the need for contract services, because we have to have redundancy too. I mean, I've got 3 different contracts, because people take vacations, they get sick, they get new employment. And when you have these, you know, you've got to have at least some depth, because you never know, you know, when you're going to, you know, okay, we got a new building like a hospital. Oh, wow, we got a whole battery of things we don't normally deal with, med gas and stuff that, you know, you wouldn't normally deal with on a normal project, you know, so.
And not to mention, you don't have the plan check people to do that kind of stuff either. Plan tech's a whole nother can
right.
of worms.
Yep.
When you're trying to look at plans, you got to go get specialists, and
you've got a lot of work to do.
This we've got it set up pretty good right now. It was tough. You should know we just put in, and Jim, you should know given your line of work. We did put in for a 20% increase on our electrical fee schedule. We did that because the county's A-level electrician, who we had under contract to provide A-level plan reviews and inspections at $75 an hour, retired. No, he's entitled to do that. You know, we've had that arrangement for years under a contract. But guess what our fallback is? Folks out of Eugene, guess what that charge is? $110 an hour. And we have to pay for their travel, you know, so that's 110 bucks for while they're driving here from Eugene, so, and back. So that's 3 hours right there minimum for them coming out. And we have to provide A-level at least twice a week. So, you know, think about that. So, okay, so now we've got them coming out here at that price, and what, maybe we have two A-level inspections out of our electrical on that given day? Not very cost effective, so we have to break it across the entire fee schedule so that we can deal with it. You know, so, you know, hopefully the county will be successful and they'll be able to hire another A-level inspector, but that's been tough going right now because things are pretty good in the trades and they don't want to be. That's how it works, you know.
Your basic source of those people are ones that are crippled up. I mean, they have hurt themselves bad enough that they no longer can work and that they end up being inspectors. Right. So, I've met most of them and it's like, that's exactly how it goes.
You do tend to have folks that are latter part of their career because, as you said, it's not fun anymore having to climb up and do the harder kind of labor aspects of it. So anyway, that's the battery of bills that I had to go through with you. That's what we have. So there, nothing kind of large omnibus like House Bill 2001 was, but there are enough targeted pieces here. We'll probably have kind of a house cleaning package to address with the legislation, maybe in one package. That's my hope. So, Jim, that's all I had on that.
Okay.
Yeah, you bet.
We did all the homeless wildfire and the Senate 458?
Yeah, I think I covered all the bills there.
Okay. So then we're on to TSP Solutions Evaluation Memo?
Right. Not planning to go through that big giant memo. I was just going to go through the project lists and maps. If you have specific concerns with what's in that memo, I'd appreciate your thoughts. If you could just email them to me, that would be great. Any changes to Tech Memo 8 will probably land in the TSP proper. That's kind of where we're going with it. We have internally a staff another round of review on this document as well that needs to be done. I forwarded it off to our public works folks. They're working on that too.
Did you see the letter to the editor?
Yes, I did. Yeah, with respect to the couplet. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That one is online.
You know, everybody has their perspective on various transportation improvements and what is or is not going to be more effective. I do want to emphasize that coming out of the project advisory committee, the long couplet was not recommended. That's the one that went in front of the highway.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Bertolite wasn't aware of that. So the short couplet's what was recommended by the project advisory committee for that area.
Now, and, we have that open house coming up on Wednesday, right?
Yep. In person, and you have the online that's going right now.
Okay.
That's up and running, and then you have the in person on Wednesday. Consultants will be out here for that, and we'll have these same charts will be available for the in person. We'll have some post-it notes where people can put their comments down on what they like or don't like. So the first map was up in the Agate Beach area. Did anybody have any specific questions about what we have identified or what they've identified for the Agate Beach area?
The enhanced pedestrian crossings.
Mm-hmm.
Will those be the flashing light type things?
Yes, that's the expectation. They may not look, they could be overhead. They come in different flavors depending upon line of sight issues. It may not just be a pole. They could be something that's elevated.
But there will be some.
But there would be some sort of flashing. Of yep, that's what those are about.
Capture people's attention.
Okay. Is there going to be any traffic? Are there going to be signals? Like beyond the current signal we have, you know, that's, what's the name of the road there?
Oh, at the BLM turn or at Zabo's?
Right, the.
North, because something needs to break up that traffic.
Absolutely. So on this map where you have it is 73rd. That's INT1. That's an intersection project.
Police station, right?
Yeah, by state police.
Yeah.
That one got pretty close when PUD came in with their maintenance facility. We get another development up there, and that's probably going to warrant, yeah, and we can do it.
No.
There was a reference, I think it was in this document, to something over basically north of UPS or north of some development, commercial development going in there or industrial.
Where the old core.
We don't have anything going in right now. The only piece that we had was the Paul Lawson piece up there was a property that ODOT and State Forestry were looking at potentially developing, but that fell apart as part of, you know, with the pandemic. ODOT scaled back, decided not to relocate, and that property was too big for State Forestry to tackle alone. I'm not aware of any additional development up in that area right now.
Across the street from PUD, that big.
That's Lawson's property.
That's the
but
one.
But there's nobody that's been talking to us about developing that recently. The last discussion we had, again, was with those two state agencies right before the pandemic hit. And then ODOT had an option on that property, and they let it expire.
That's zoned industrial, right?
Yep, that's I-2, and I think there's a small piece in this I-3.
Well, that'd be good, because something needs to break that traffic up a little bit because with the low-income housing up there and all that, it's just getting impossible to even. I mean, people are just wall-to-wall traffic, so.
The other thing about these enhanced crossings, there hasn't been any discussion, to my recollection, about, and this may be too minute, too finite, changing some of the left turn signals to be like the one at Lighthouse Drive, where it blinks yellow and you can turn instead of just sitting there on an empty street with a red turn arrow.
Yeah.
Are they going to look at that and make recommendations, or?
That's usually captured as a signal optimization project where they do the whole corridor and kind of take a look at, not instead of a one-off. Although we have done some one-offs, and frankly, we did that one right on 101 at Walmart, where they did that.
The one, and then yeah, that's the one I'm talking about.
And then they scaled it back because we were having traffic accidents, and so it got adjusted slightly.
Darwin is our friend.
Well, there are several places where it's just the most annoying thing in the world when there's absolutely no traffic coming and you're.
Oh, that's where you gotta sit there.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
wait.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
gotta sit even there and now. Wait for.
Yeah.
Now, I would never just go ahead and go through, but some people do.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people.
I still remember that.
Lack of patience.
Randolph did that. Got pulled over, got a ticket for it.
Really?
Yeah, it's like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on with respect to this particular map?
No, I mean, I just wanted to point out to Bill and Bob about the roundabout at your intersection.
Yeah, that's yeah. Fun. Oh, that'll be fun. I'll go around it several times every day.
You know, it's funny. That's easier to get through ODOT's traffic warrants than a signal is. So.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, with the heavy truck traffic, that would be we'd have to look and see really what kind of real estate are you talking about, because it's a lot of truck traffic shooting through that intersection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, those are bigger turn radius. It's a bigger roundabout.
Yeah.
So Jim, did you want to just take a break away from the work session?
Yeah.
This would be seem like
let's
a good
do the.
And we'll just.
Do we have anybody on Zoom or on the phone line?
No.
Then I'm going to skip the Zoom etiquette thing and jump into.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah.
Sherry.